This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, April 22nd, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. For those who wield significant power in the federal government's executive branch, what should be the process for allowing them to serve? Cato's Tommy Berry details who can solve that problem of big executive branch power wielded by people who haven't been confirmed by the Senate. Tommy, you've written extensively on this topic on a number of occasions in different formats and tackling this from different angles. But when we talk about an officer, somebody who is serving in the executive branch, what are we talking about?
Well, fundamentally, we're talking about someone who exercises significant authority. That's the terminology that the Supreme Court has developed. So it's anyone who has the power to make decisions that affect normal citizens' lives. That could be an administrative law judge who decides whether you have to pay a fine for allegedly violating some rule an agency has set down, or could be a bureaucrat or an administrator who's set out a new rule in the Federal Reporter that says what fees you have to pay, what fines you have to pay, what rules you have to follow when building homes. Anything and everything across the scope of the federal government's power, it's exercised and decisions are made by officers. And that's why the Constitution put in safeguards for how those officers are chosen and who that power is entrusted in.
And what the approval process is for those people to serve in those roles.
Exactly. With the default that most people are aware of being Senate confirmation, the classic president picks someone, nominates someone, but they don't start serving. They aren't officially appointed until the Senate has vetted and approved them. That's the required rule for many positions, such as Supreme Court justices and other judges and top-level officials. And it's the default rule even for lower-level federal officers.
And the case that you have studied fairly extensively is the case of Matt Whitaker, who became, in the Trump administration, acting attorney general after the departure of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, who had been Donald Trump's AG.
That's right. And what was particularly concerning about Whitaker was that he was not serving in any other Senate-confirmed position. So what you most commonly see when a cabinet member departs is that the deputy cabinet member, the deputy head of the department, takes over as the acting officer. We have an example of that right now. Julie Hsu is the acting secretary of labor. She was deputy secretary of labor and had been confirmed by the Senate to that position. That raises less of a constitutional concern because there's already been a vetting process. Whitaker was serving as chief of staff to Sessions, which is not a Senate-confirmed role. So the Senate had never played a part. Not only did it not play a part in him becoming the acting, which it never does, it didn't even play a part in him taking his prior role.
How do you expect this to be sorted, the issue of, giving Congress its say over the management of executive branch agencies?
There are really two actors who could solve this problem, either the Supreme Court or Congress. So as I recount in the article, the Supreme Court in 1898 decided this old case called United States versus Eaton. And this case predates all of the modern cases that have really set out our current doctrine for the Appointments Clause. Today, it really looks kind of rudimentary and doesn't get into the original meaning of the Appointments Clause at all. And that Eaton case said that if someone temporarily takes over the powers of a principal officer, you don't need to have Senate consent for them or else government operations would be seriously hindered. It was really kind of a pragmatic decision, not a decision based on constitutional text. So one thing the Supreme Court could do that I've advocated is just overrule that case. I think it's inconsistent with the more recent case that has set out the general rule called Edmund from 1997 that said anyone who has no superior but the president is a principal officer who has to be confirmed by the Senate, no exceptions. And whether you're a permanent cabinet officer for 4 years or an acting cabinet officer for one day, the same thing applies. You have no superior during that time than the president. So I think Edmund is just inconsistent with the Eaton rule that accepts and exempts acting officers from Senate consent. The other option is that Congress can step in. So the reason that the president is able to appoint acting officers to any position is this law called the Vacancies Act that's been amended and reformed several times, most recently in 1998, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. And it allows the president to appoint acting officers and gives three options for who he can choose: someone Senate confirmed, or someone who is the deputy, even if they weren't Senate confirmed, or anyone at the GS-15 level of the civil service, which is basically the highest ranking sort of career bureaucrat. And in my view, Congress should and could amend that to say, well, but for cabinet-level officials or other high-ranking officials, it needs to be someone Senate-confirmed, and it needs to be someone Senate-confirmed in that department. If they had passed an amendment like that, Whitaker no longer would have been an option.
I'm trying to put myself in the mind of either a president or the head of an agency or members of Congress that don't like taking these kinds of votes. You know, Tommy, when we're in a very difficult spot, when our country is in a difficult spot and a vacancy has occurred either by death or a sudden departure, we need to have continuity in our government. We need to have that. And if the only way to get that is to have somebody who isn't Senate confirmed head an agency, well, so be it. The American people demand that our agencies continue to work for them, even in unforeseen circumstances.
That's the argument I most commonly hear, and it's especially a concern right after a changeover in administrations from one party to the other, because traditionally most people who are Senate confirmed resign if a Democratic president succeeds a Republican or vice versa. So there's just not a lot of people to choose from if you're looking for Senate confirmed holdovers. We saw at the very beginning of the Trump administration, for example, there were a couple acting attorney generals for a short period of time, holdovers from the Obama administration. Very quickly, we saw that there was a fundamental disagreement on policy there, and it didn't really work. In my view, what I've argued in the article is that this is not an insurmountable problem. You can get more creative with the crop of acting officers that are available and Senate-confirmed possibilities. So there are many career officers in the civil service who are respected by both parties, who have served as caretaker acting heads in both parties. The same person was acting head of the Department of Education under both Biden and Trump at the beginning of their administrations for a couple weeks. I argue that you should simply create a process, Congress can do this, to leave those people in the jobs they're in, but also have the Senate confirm them specifically for eligibility to serve as caretaker cabinet members, and essentially say, we're vetting this person, we're aware that by doing this, we're giving them eligibility to serve as caretakers, and we're okay with that, whether it's under a Republican or a Democrat. I'm confident there's at least five or six bureaucrats in every department that could win confirmation for that purpose, and then you would allow them to serve much as they're doing now, but having been vetted by the Senate and eliminating this constitutional problem.
What are the risks here of not making these changes, or rather allowing a president to simply name somebody over which Congress has had no say to run or be a high-level deputy in an executive agency?
Well, the first risk was set out in the Federalist Papers. Federalist 76 talked about why we have the Appointments Clause, and it said if we didn't, we wouldn't have a check against the appointment of unfit characters. There was a big debate at the Constitutional Convention. Should appointments be chosen by one person or by a whole committee? And it was thought, well, if it's by committee, it might be more likely to avoid cronyism or avoid, you know, favoritism. But they thought that there would be just sort of too much fighting and it would be too hard to have a consensus. So we got this compromise. One person identifies the nominee, the president, but the Senate has to confirm them and provide a check, provide the security. Okay, this person is qualified. He or she is not just a crony. If that person is, we're going to vote them down and you have to pick someone different. So by circumventing that rule, you've gotten rid of that check. You run the risk of the appointment of unfit characters. Now, the Constitution does allow for exempting Senate consent, but only for inferior officers. And the reason for that was the notion that, okay, but the inferior officers will be supervised by Senate-confirmed officers. So everyone in the executive branch will be one of two things, either confirmed by the Senate or supervised and potentially fireable by someone confirmed by the Senate. So no matter what, you can trace accountability back by a pretty direct chain. And that's not what you have when you have an acting cabinet head who is not confirmed by the Senate. And then constitutionally, I think you also run the risk of litigation. You know, Eaton does stand in the way currently, but I think especially if the Supreme Court ever reconsiders Eaton, every action taken by an acting cabinet member who is not confirmed by the Senate, I think is vulnerable to court challenge. So especially with the current court is very concerned about structural constitutional issues. They've struck down a lot of actions by agencies and administrative law judges because of appointments clause problems that might have been seen as too formalistic an issue to care about a decade or more ago. So I think it's in the executive branch's own interest to get rid of this risk and kind of clean up this practice.
Can we talk about the practical realities of court challenges related to this? These are temporary for the most part, right? These appointments are often short-lived, and it's only due to some, maybe not a creative interpretation, but the vagaries of these vacancies and the laws currently governing those vacancies that allow presidents to go around the rules for a little bit, maybe have their person stay there a little longer. But the point is that it's temporary, courts move slowly, and how would we go about getting an effective court challenge to these kinds of appointments if those people are going to be out of office soon enough?
It's absolutely a difficult problem. So the most common avenue is to challenge rules that they issued. I was involved in my prior job at Pacific Legal Foundation. I was involved in a lawsuit challenging a rule that we thought was issued by someone who was not properly confirmed under the appointments clause. It is a problem, both because litigation moves slowly and, as you said, if later on in the course of litigation that person has been replaced by someone Senate confirmed, what happens is that the replacement will often ratify the rule. And that's just a legal term that basically says, you know, whatever my predecessor might have done and whatever problems there might have been with his authority, I have undisputed authority, and I'm just going to say I vouch for or I redo whatever action he took. So now there's no problem. This is exactly what happened for Whitaker. So Whitaker issued a controversial rule called the bump stock rule. Coincidentally, it's at the Supreme Court now on the merits on a statutory interpretation question, but it was also challenged under the appointments clause, saying Whitaker didn't have this authority. But predictably, what happened is that Whitaker was soon replaced by Bill Barr. Bill Barr ratified the rule, and so every challenge to the bump stock rule failed under the appointments clause, either under Eaton or under the theory that Barr ratified it. And often courts will even not reach the constitutional question. They won't even decide whether, for example, Whitaker had authority or not, because they'll say, no harm, no foul. Even if he didn't, Barr does have authority. And that is really a hindrance on the development of the law, because then you don't even set a precedent for future cases.
Tommy Berry is editor of the Cato Institute's annual Supreme Court Review. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you like, and thank you for listening.